The months that followed were the most contented that Santen had ever known, secure and sunny and rewarding, filled with the sound of Shasa's laughter and with the benign, if diffident, presence of Gary Courtney always in the background and the more substantial figure of Anna in the foreground. Santen rode every morning before breakfast and again in the cool of the evening, and often Gary accompanied her, regaling her with tales of Michael's childhood or relating the family history as they climbed the forested tracks along the escarpment or paused to water the horses at the pool below the falls of the river where the spray and white water fell 100 feet over the wet black rock. The rest of the day was spent in choosing curtaining and wallpaper and supervising the artisans who were redecorating the house, consulting with Anna on the restructuring of Tjernaskral's domestic arrangements, romping with Shasa and trying to prevent the Zulu servants from spoiling him utterly, taking instruction from Gary Courtney in the subtle art of steering and driving the big Fiat Tourer and pondering the printed invitations that arrived with every day's mail, and generally taking over the management and running of Tjernaskral, as she had that of the chateau at Mortom. Every afternoon she and Shasa took tea with Gary in the library, where he had been ensconced for most of the day, and with his gold-rimmed spectacles on the end of his nose, he would read aloud to her his day's writings.
"Oh, it is wonderful to have such a gift," she exclaimed, and he lowered the sheaf of manuscript.
"You admire those of us that write?" he asked.
"You are a breed apart."
"Nonsense, my dear. We are very ordinary people, except that we are vain enough to believe that other people might want to read what we have to say."
"I wish I could write."
"You can. Your penmanship is excellent."
"I mean, really write."
"You can. Help yourself to paper and get on with it, if that's what you want."
"But," she stared at him aghast, "what could I write about?"
"Write about what happened to you, out there in the desert. That would do very well for a beginning, I should say." It took 3 days for her to accustom herself to the idea and brace herself to the effort. Then she had the servants move a table into the gazebo at the end of the lawns and sat down at it with a pencil in her hand, a pile of Gary's blank paper in front of her and terror in her heart. She experienced that same terror each day thereafter when she drew the first blank sheet of paper towards her, but it passed swiftly as the ranks of words began to march down across the emptiness. She moved pleasant and familiar things into the gazebo to alleviate the loneliness of creative endeavour, a pretty rug for the tiled floor, a Delft vase on the tabletop which Anna filled with fresh flowers each day. And in front of her, she placed Owa's clasp knife. She used it to resharpen her pencils. At her right hand, she placed a velvet-lined jewel box, and in it she laid Hani's necklace. Whenever she lacked inspiration, she threw down her pencil and took up the necklace. She rubbed the bright stones between her fingers like Greek worry beads, and their cool, smooth touch seemed to calm her and recharge her determination. Every afternoon from the end of lunch until it was time to take tea with Gary in the library, she wrote at the table in the gazebo, and Shasa slept in the cot beside her or climbed over her feet. It did not take many days for Santen to realize that she could never show what she was putting onto the paper to another living soul. She found that she could hold nothing back, that she was writing with a brutal candour that admitted no reserve or equivocation. Whether it was the details of her lovemaking with Michael or the description of the taste of rotten fish in her mouth as she lay dying beside the Atlantic, she knew that nobody could read them without being shocked and horrified.
"It's for myself alone," she decided.
At the end of each session, when she laid the handwritten sheets on the jewel box on top of Hani's necklace, she was suffused with a sense of satisfaction and worthwhile achievement. There were, however, a few jarring notes in this symphony of contentment. Sometimes in the night, she would rise to the surface of consciousness and reach instinctively for the lithe golden body that should have been beside hers, longing for the feel of hard, smooth muscle and the touch of long, silky hair that smelled like the sweet grasses of the desert. Then she would become fully awake and lie in the darkness, hating herself for her treacherous longings and burning with shame that she had so debased the memory of Michael and Owa and little Hani. On another morning, Gary Courtney sent for her and, when she was seated, handed her a package. "This came with a covering note to me. It's from a lawyer in Paris."
"What does it say, Papa?"
"My French is awful, I'm afraid, but the gist of the matter is that your father's estates at Mortomme have been sold to defray his debts."
"Oh, poor Papa."
"They had presumed that you were dead, my dear, and the sale was ordered by a French court."
"I understand."
"The lawyer read of your rescue in a Parisian paper and has written to me explaining the situation. Unfortunately, the Comte de Thierry's debts were considerable. And, as you are too well aware, the chateau and its contents were destroyed in the fire. The lawyer has set out an accounting, and after all the debts were paid and the legal expenses, including this fellow's not inconsiderable fees, were deducted, there is very little that remains to you." Santan's healthy, acquisitive instincts were aroused.
"How much, Papa?"
she asked sharply. "A little less than £2,000 sterling, I'm afraid. He will send a bank draft when we return the acknowledgement to him, duly signed and attested. Fortunately, I am a commissioner of oaths, so we can do the business privately." When the draft finally arrived, Santan deposited the most part with the Ladyburg Bank at 3.5% interest, indulging only her new passion for speed. She used £120 to buy herself a T-model Ford, resplendent in brass and glistening black paintwork, and when, for the first time, she tore up the driveway of Tjernaskral at 30 miles per hour, the entire household turned out to admire the machine. Even Gary Courtney hurried from the library, his gold-rimmed spectacles pushed up on top of his head. And it was the first time he ever chided her. "You must consult me, my dear, before you do these things. I will not have you squandering your own savings. I am your provider, and besides which," he looked lugubrious, "I was looking forward to buying you a motor car for your next birthday. You've gone and spoiled my plans."
"Oh, Papa, do forgive me. You have given us so much already, and we love you for it."
It was true. She had come to love this gentle person in many ways, as she had loved her own father, but in some ways even more strongly, for her feelings towards him were bolstered by growing respect for and awareness of his unvaunted talents and his hidden qualities, his deep humanity and his fortitude in the face of a fate that had deprived him of a limb, a wife and a son, and had withheld from him until this late hour a loving family. He treated her like the mistress of his household, and this evening he was discussing the guest lists for the dinner party they were planning. "I must warn you about this fellow Robinson. I gave myself pause before inviting him. I'll tell you." Her mind had been on these other things, however, not on the invitation list, and she started.
"I'm so sorry, Papa," she apologized. "I did not hear what you were saying. I'm afraid I was dreaming."
"Dear me," Gary smiled at her. "I thought I was the only dreamer in the family. I was warning you about our guest of honour." Gary liked to entertain twice a month, not more often, and there were always 10 dinner guests, never more. "I like to hear what everybody has to say," he explained. "Hate to miss a good story at the end of the table." He had a discerning palate, and had accumulated one of the finest cellars in the country. He had stolen his Zulu chef from the country club in Durban, so his invitations were sought after, even though acceptance usually involved a train journey and an overnight stay at Tjernaskral. This fellow, Joseph Robinson, may have a baronetcy, which in many cases is the mark of an unprincipled scoundrel too cunning to have been caught out. He may have more money than even old Cecil John ever accumulated. The Robinson Deep and Robinson Gold Mine belong to him, as does the Robinson Bank, but he is as mean as any man I've ever met. He'll spend £10,000 on a painting and grudge a starving man a penny. He is also a bully and the greediest, most heartless man I've ever met. When the Prime Minister first tried to get a peerage for him, there was such an outcry that he had to drop the idea.
If he's so awful, why do we invite him, Papa?
Gary sighed theatrically. A price I have to pay for my art, my dear. I am going to try to prize from the fellow a few facts that I need for my new book. He is the only living person who can give them to me.
Do you want me to charm him for you?
Oh, no, no. We don't have to go that far. But you could wear a pretty dress, I suppose. Santan chose the yellow taffeta with the embroidered seed-pearl bodice that exposed her shoulders, still lightly tanned by the desert sun. As always, Anna was there to prepare her hair and help her dress for the dinner. Santan came through from her private bathroom, which was one of the great luxuries of her new life, with a bathrobe wrapped around her still damp body and a hand towel around her head. She left wet footprints on the yellow wood floor as she crossed to her dressing table. Anna, who was seated on the bed, restitching the hook and eye on the back of the yellow dress, bit off the thread, spat it out, and mumbled,
"I have let it out 3 full centimetres, too many of these fancy dinner parties, young lady."
She laid out the dress with care and came to stand behind Santan.
"I do wish you would sit down to dinner with us," Santan grumbled. "You aren't a servant here."
Santan would have had to be blind not to have realized the relationship that was flourishing between Gary and Anna. So far, however, she had not found an opportunity of discussing it, though she longed to share Anna's joy, if only vicariously. Anna seized the silver-backed brush and attacked Santan's hair with long, powerful strokes, which jerked her head backwards.
"You want me to waste my time listening to a lot of fancy folk hissing away like a giggle of geese?"
She imitated the sibilance of the English tongue so cleverly that Santan giggled delightedly.
"No, thank you. I can't understand a word of that clever chatter, and old Anna is a lot happier and more useful in the kitchen keeping an eye on those grinning black rogues."
"Papa Gary so wants you to join the company. He's spoken to me ever so often. I think he's becoming so fond of you."
Anna pursed her lips and sniffed.
"That's enough of that nonsense, young lady," she said firmly,
as she set down the brush and arranged the fine yellow net over Santan's hair, capturing its springing curls in the spangled mesh set with yellow sequins.
"Pas mal,"
she stood back and nodded critical approval. "Now for the dress." She went to fetch it from the bed, while Santan stood up and slipped the bathrobe from her shoulders. She let it fall to the floor and stood naked before the mirror.
"The scar on your leg is healing well, but you are still so brown," Anna lamented,
and then broke off and stood with the yellow dress half extended, frowning thoughtfully, staring at Santan.
"Santan," her voice was sharp. "When did you last see your moon?" she demanded,
and Santan stooped and snatched up the fallen robe, covering herself with it defensively.
"I was sick, Anna. The blow on my head and the infection."
"How long since your last moon?"
Anna was remorseless.
"You don't understand. I was sick, don't you remember, when I had pneumonia? I also missed..."
"Not since the desert."
Anna answered her own question.
"Not since you came out of the desert with that German, that crossbreed German-Africana."
She threw the dress onto the bed and pulled the covering robe away from Santan's body.
"No, Anna, I was sick."
Santan was trembling. Up to that minute, she had truly closed her mind against the awful possibility that Anna now presented. Anna placed her big calloused hand on Santan's belly, and she cringed from the touch. I never trusted him, with his cat's eyes and yellow hair and that great bulge in his breeches, Anna muttered furiously. Now I understand why you would not speak to him when we left, why you treated him like an enemy, not a savior. Anna, I've missed before. It could be he raped you, my poor child. He violated you. You could not help it. That's how it happened. Santan recognized the escape that Anna was offering her, and she yearned to take it.
He forced you, my baby, didn't he? Tell Anna. No, Anna, he did not force me. You allowed him? You let him?
Anna's expression was formidable.
I was so lonely.
Santan sank down onto the stool and covered her face with her hands.
I had not seen another white person for almost 2 years, and he was so kind and beautiful, and I owed him my life. Don't you understand, Anna? Please say you understand.
Anna enfolded her in those thick, powerful arms, and Santan pressed her face into her soft, warm bosom. Both of them were silent, shaken and afraid.
You cannot have it, Anna said at last. We will have to get rid of it.
The shock of her words racked Santan, so she trembled afresh and tried to hide from the dreadful thought. We cannot bring another bastard to Tunas Kraal. They would not stand for it. The shame would be too much. They have taken one, but Mynheer and the General could not take another. For the sake of all of us, Michael's family and Shasa, for yourself, for all of those whom I love, there is no choice in the matter. You must get rid of it.
Anna, I can't do that.
Do you love this man who put it in your belly?
Not now.
Not anymore. I hate him, she whispered. Oh, God, how I hate him.
Then get rid of his breath before it destroys you and Shasa and all of us.